DW Africa Link.
What happens when the US decides to deport migrants and convicted criminals not to their home countries, but to places they've never set foot in? That's the reality under Donald Trump's controversial third country deportation policy, and it's sparking outrage. From Eswatini to South Sudan, African nations are being asked or pressured by the US to accept deportees rejected by their own governments. Human rights groups are sounding the alarm. African activists are pushing back. And the question remains, is this immigration reform or international exploitation? And what's the way forward? That's what's coming up. I am Eddie Micah Jr., and you are welcome to Africa Link, the podcast connecting you to the stories that matter.
Africa Link, every weekday, here on DW.
In July, a U.S. deportation flight landed in Eswatini, carrying five convicted criminals from Vietnam, Jamaica, Laos, Cuba, and Yemen. None of them had any ties to Eswatini. Their home countries refused to take them back. So the Trump administration found a workaround, sent them to a third country willing to accept them. Eswatini, a tiny kingdom ruled by Africa's last absolute monarch, agreed. So did South Sudan. Rwanda is reportedly next. The Trump administration calls it a win for public safety. Critics call it a human rights disaster. Let's get more from Ezenwa Nwagu, the executive director of the Peering Advocacy and Advancement Center in Africa. That's a civil society organization focused on good governance, accountability, and transparency. Ezenwa, welcome to Africa Link. So, U.S. deporting unwanted migrants and convicted criminals to countries they've never set foot in. What do you make of what's going on?
It's about pushing back people, you know, pushing out unwanted, in quotes, unwanted people in their country to, you know, other countries through some kind of backhand, under the table agreements. That are not open, that are in real terms very opaque. And what is even more worrying is that he has had to use Supreme Court ruling that upturned the lower court ruling that has tried to protect the rights of this immigrant.
Can you explain the legal framework behind this? Is it even legal the way it's being done?
The whole uprooting, completely uprooting from a place, from the known to the unknown. And that challenge is a violation. So if you talk about legal, the Trump administration would claim legality, but this is much more than legality. It has more to do now with, you know, what the Trump administration is putting out to the world, that Americans were better than you. And then these people that have been returned, many of them, you know, sometimes have been labeled criminals. So even when you take them to those countries, what are you expecting that they'll be doing there?
I mean, there's a reason that human rights groups and human rights organizations are sounding the alarm, right? Isn't that the problem here, that international law somehow is not holding? Because that cannot be the widely accepted way to go about this, right? Or is it just, okay, a transaction is done, and if the other country's government allows it, then that should make it okay?
Well, what you hinted to was the normal function of international relations, where agreements have been reached as to if a Nigerian commits a crime in the U.S., you can repatriate or send back that person to Nigeria. But there are procedures, and those procedures are sometimes the bureaucratic bottlenecks to it can be very challenging. So what all of this is doing, the third country repatriation is actually to circumvent those procedures. And it's American first policy of Trump. So it's a violation. Everyone sees this as clear violation of the right of those people. And like I said, a subversion of the procedures, internationally defined procedures for repatriation. And that is why there is that outcry. And you know that a lot of human rights groups, civil society, and public interest lawyers are already, filing court cases to make sure that this doesn't stand.
because it's not legal, right?
When you subvert procedures, it is not right. I don't think we should hinge the conversation or make it too legalistic. Because if you hinge on legality, then that will lead us to much more deeper conversation about, you know, international jurisprudence and all the rest of it.
Okay, what should we hinge it on then?
The political consequences, the sovereignty of the countries that these people are being brought to, and the rights of those migrants who have been, you know, in many cases kept in very, you know, decrepit conditions, tortured in many cases. Those are the political questions that we need to resolve.
Right. How do these deals differ from traditional deportation agreements?
They differ to the extent that if I commit a crime in the US, I am brought back to my own country through a known process defined clearly already by international agreements and conventions. But this time around, to circumvent that, I have to be taken to Rwanda or to whichever other country that agrees that they are ready to receive, you know, migrants who have been deported in this way. So the challenge is that no matter what the argument is, the traditional means of doing this is through bilateral agreements that are already entered. And once you don't follow that process, you have violated these agreements, and there are consequences for it. But what has happened is that, everyone knows, the American government is using, you know, persuasion, transactional, and other, you know, means to make sure that some of these countries agree to these terms. And like you said, and we know Rwanda, for instance, says it's ready to accept. And I know that there are countries, but I know that Nigeria officials have spoken very critically of this arrangements, and they are not taking it.
Right. I mean, what does this policy, especially considering that the US is now approaching African countries too, what does this policy say about the current state of US-Africa relations under Trump?
This policy is a reflection of Trump's administration's America First. He has made it very clear. It's just about America, and no consideration for, you know, bilateral agreements, no consideration for historical ties that bind America. And there are people within America who are speaking up against. So in reality, it is that, you know, I called it American superiority complex, nobody has epitomized that more than the Trump administration. They've come very strong in saying that it's for them America, America, and then America.
What concerns should African countries have about this? I mean, it's only a matter of time which country could be next. And if the Trump administration says, okay, take these guys in, or, you know, we're going to hike your tariffs, right? Instead of 15%, you're going to now pay 30% tariffs before you can trade with the US. What kind of precedents could this be setting for many years to come? And how should African countries be dealing with this?
I think our response to this will be to ensure that we make our continent much better for our citizens, in a way that those who will want to live will be living based on, you know, very just and clear, you know, desire to pursue maybe education or business and the rest of them. But what triggers the kind of immigration we have from Africa, and which brings this, diplomatic insult to Africa, is the fact that the question of good governance, the question of, you know, livable spaces for majority of the citizens are currently challenged in most of Africa. So we need to introspect, we need to be autochthonous in our thinking, and see how we can make things much better for the majority of our people who live in Africa. in a way that they don't go and expose themselves to the kind of degradation, you know, human degradation that we are seeing from not just the US. If you know, there is the UK-Rwandan agreement, there is the Pacific solution from, you know, is it Germany and the rest of them. So all of this is response to the lack of the challenge of governance and the crisis of leadership that Africa is presently confronting.
Right, which is fair enough. You're talking about long term here, though. But now, with the pressure that some countries may end up facing, what is the best way to deal with this now? I mean, could you just say no?
I think we could support human rights lawyers who are already entering the legal arena on this issue and see what conclusive determination that can happen for which, you know, which possibly can strengthen the hand of African governments to be able to stand up to the Americans. But much more than anything, whether long term or short term, the big question would be that you have put yourself in a position where you are being dictated to, and then there are subterranean means to and backhand methods through which, you know, the American government is trying to force this. Once you hear force, it means that there is an unwilling relationship. And if it's an unwilling relationship, the one who is being subjected has to determine. It's still the fight for independence. That fight for independence is a continuation. So whatever we used to get independence for Africa, for most of Africa, we need to reinvent those issues. The first is our self-esteem as Africans, our confidence in our own abilities to solve our own problems, and then we can use it to confront an enemy outside.
So for those countries, for those African countries that may end up agreeing a deal to take these migrants in, whether it's South Sudan or Eswatini or whichever other African country, what would you advise they look at before agreeing to such a deal in a way that they somehow benefit from it, if that is how we want to look at it?
If benefit is money, if benefit is trade, if benefit is increased trade, if benefit is better diplomatic relations, those are some of the things that you can consider. But there is also the place of pride, the place of self-realization as a people, that you will be accepting people from other countries who are not your citizens, you know, and who are being uprooted from where they are. There are deeper sociological responses that can come rather than just that transactional engagement that we are seeing with the countries, because no country is coming out clearly. What we know is that it has to do with much more, it's too transactional, and there is no sociological thinking around the long-term effect of these repatriations.
And that is definitely a very good time to ask you this then. What could be the long-term impact or effect?
Is colonialism afresh? It is that continued feeling that, you know, America would be it and know it of every issue in the world. And I think that young Africans, people like us at this point in time, will have to find a way to begin to put our own feet, you know, in the sands of international and global politics in a way that makes it difficult for this kind of considerations. Why are you not deporting people to UK? Why are you not taking them back to Europe or to, you know, other places? Why Africa? What message are you trying to send? The long-term impact is going to be, you know, psychologically, sociological damaging in terms of our self, you know, respect for ourselves as a people and as a continent.
Which is a very interesting and key point you've just raised. But also, what can be said about what happens to society itself, the infrastructure that is needed, you know, to take care of these migrants that have been brought in, and you know, the impact that could have on society. What do you have to say to that?
Well, the countries that are agreeing to these agreements will surely make an assessment of whether they have the capacity. I've seen the argument of Rwanda saying that, you know, Africa is one, and so they are willing to be able to do that. If they have the capacity to suck in these people, and it does not, it has a debilitating or deleterious consequence on, you know, their facilities and infrastructure, that's fine. But most of Africa is already crying for, you know, worsening health conditions, bad roads, and lack of medicines for hospitals. And so if this is the general condition, then you can't be talking in terms of what will be the impact. The impact will be very, very consequential.
What role can civil society and indeed other international organizations play in challenging or monitoring these deals?
Well, I think it's litigation, is to test it out in the international court. And I know that South Africa Litigation Center has already filed a court application to challenge the deportation. And I think that in Ghana, in Nigeria, we should have public interest litigation around this issue and see what comes out of it. Just like you've done this morning and every other place, I think we can topic these issues of this forced deportation and create very strong awareness around it in a way that educates and mobilizes, you know, most of Africa to be able to see what consequence this will mean in future.
Right. Ezenwa Nwagu, Executive Director of the Peering Advocacy and Advancement Center in Africa. That's a civil society organization focused on good governance, accountability, and transparency. Thank you very much for your time.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so much.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
And it's not just activists, right? The UN has warned that deporting people to countries with poor human rights records, for example, without due process, could violate international law. The US Supreme Court recently allowed these deportations to proceed, overruling protections under the Convention Against Torture. Now, this decision essentially means that the US can deport individuals to countries where they may face torture or other forms of inhumane treatment. South Sudan is one of the African countries that is willing to accept these migrants. Our correspondent, Patrick Oyet, in Juba. So, Patrick, can you describe the public reaction in South Sudan to the arrival of deported migrants from the US?
So far, all the people that I've spoken to are not happy about the arrival of the deportees from the US. That is because many of them have questions rather than answers. People are asking, why are these people deported to South Sudan now, especially at a time when the U.S. has actually revoked all visas issued to South Sudanese people. Also, the visas have been banned for South Sudanese. You can't apply for a visa. There are students who are affected, who are supposed to be at school in the U.S. They cannot go. There are families that are affected, that some of them wanted to visit their family members. They cannot go. So people are not really happy about this issue. Also, due to the fact that the government has not really come out clearly to explain circumstances surrounding these deportees. The government only made a blanket statement that, yes, we have a bilateral agreement, and as such, this is being done on humanitarian ground and so forth. But there is no opportunity for journalists or even for the general public to ask questions and be answered. And that has made people really to ask more questions, to which questions they're not getting the answer. So many people are not happy about the deportees from the U.S. being brought here.
So were local authorities or communities informed or prepared for their arrival?
The second question is, were local authorities or communities informed or prepared for their arrival? No, the local authority in South Sudan or communities were never informed about the arrival of the deportees. In fact, even the local media were never informed. Most of the stories were being seen either from the media from the US reporting about it, or media, at least from other countries, reporting about it. But officials within South Sudan, you could ask, they would never talk about this. It was only the police who said, well, if they come, we shall assess. And if we find that some of them have to be, you know, taken to their countries of origin, they'll be taken. But there was really no consultation with communities, no consultations with local authorities, and that itself also has created some negativity among the people in the country.
What do we know about the conditions these deportees are facing? I'm talking about issues like housing, legal status, or even access to basic services.
Typically, we know nothing about where these deportees are being kept. One of the challenges that, of course, authorities in South Sudan talk about is the lack of facilities for keeping inmates. For example, the Juba prisons, which is built by the British, and it is meant to only accommodate about 500 people, is currently accommodating more than 2,000 people. So there's a problem of accommodating inmates. And up to now, we as journalists or many of the people of South Sudan do not really know where these people who are brought from the U.S. are being kept. It is kept as a secret. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs only came and posted information online saying that they are being kept in a safe place. They are being scrutinized and for their own safety, but they did not disclose really where exactly these people are being kept, which remains a mystery for the people of South Sudan.
Have civil society groups or religious leaders responded to the deportations?
The civil societies have come out. They have asked the government to make open the agreement that the government of South Sudan has with the U.S. government on the issue of deportation. But the churches have been quiet. The civil society's request, of course, has not been responded to. The government just listened to it and kept quiet. So, but they have made that request to the government that this agreement has to be made public. People should know about it, what it contains, and so forth.
What do ordinary South Sudanese citizens think about their country, in a sense, being used as a destination for foreign deportees?
Yeah, many South Sudanese people are unhappy about this. They think it is a matter of South Sudan being weak, so therefore the U.S., for example, is using it as a dumping ground for people that it doesn't want, but that South Sudan does not have any powers to reject. This is being used that if you refuse, we shall do ABCD.
Patrick Oyette, DW correspondent in Juba, South Sudan. Thank you very much.
Abuja, Nairobi, Harare. Africa Link's correspondents bring African stories to you.
Trump's policy is part of a broader trend. Western nations are outsourcing deportations to Africa. The UK tried it with Rwanda, and Denmark too has attempted similar actions. Nigeria has refused to play ball, calling it a new colonial move. Rwanda has agreed to take in up to 250 migrants deported from the U.S. under a new deal signed in Kigali. Locals are divided. Some see opportunity, others worry.
Welcoming foreigners has become part of Rwanda's culture. It reflects the humanity of Rwandans. Let them come, because they may introduce jobs and skills we didn't know before. And we can learn from them.
Welcoming immigrants is not a problem for us as Rwandans. We can learn from them. However, my concern is that some of our cultural values might change, especially the youth who may adopt behaviors brought by these newcomers that could have negative consequences.
Many young people are unemployed, and I worry that the arrival of immigrants will increase the population and that will bring unemployment issues. We hope that those who send them will also send support to take care of them, because unemployment is already high and they might add to it.
Critics warn that this isn't just about immigration, it's about power, sovereignty, and human dignity. So what do you think? Your voice matters, so please share your thoughts with us on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Listen to us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from. And hey, don't forget to click follow and subscribe to our DW Africa YouTube channel so you never miss an episode. This show was co-produced and edited by Isaac Mugabe. I am Eddie Micah Jr. Thanks for listening.
DW. Made for Minds.